If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Julie Heaton is a UK-based free machine embroidery artist. Julie's embroidered artwork has been an exploration of her path to recovery following her husband's suicide in 2009. Recovery isn't the right word, but Julie recognises that she's found a point of stability following something that was an earth-shattering event for her. Her machine-embroidered pieces have depth and quality and feeling and emotion, and she recognises that the events that took place have brought her to this position of artistic expression right now. This is the first part of our conversation, and I'm sorry that I'm not being very eloquent here, but it's quite hard to talk about this stuff easily. In this episode, full warning, we talk at some length about the effect that her husband's suicide had on her family. But throughout all of this, there's a sense that she wouldn't be here now making the work that she's making had that not happened. And while nobody ever wishes suicide to be a thing, it's not that there's good that's come from it, but I think Julie recognises that she's been on a journey and she's still on that journey, and the place that she's in now is about as good a place as you could hope to be. It's a fascinating conversation. I really love talking with Julie. It was really deep and meaningful, and I think she's got a lot to say on the subject. If you know anybody who's been affected by this sort of thing, there are mental health charities and lots of online help available and support, and I think that's something that we touch on as well. So this episode is a bit heavy. It ends nicely, and obviously we'll be back next week with the second half of the conversation. So do visit Julie's work at julieheaton.com or find Julie Heaton Artist on Instagram, and you'll see why her work's amazing and why it was really good to talk to her. So I hope you enjoy the show. I apologise that I've not been able to speak very easily about it, but you know, it's quite a topic. So thanks for being there. I'll see you next week. Take care. There's something about, I don't know whether it's me or something, but I love normal things being immortalized. So with that said, why don't you tell us all about the people on the tube and how it happened? Because I want to know all about that one as well, because technically that was quite challenging for you. And I think that's a great place to start.
Okay, well, that's that's a really good story behind that one. So when I was on my BA in Bath, I was making some work that were drawings of things that were in my husband's drawer at work. After he died, they had to clear the drawer out, and I was given this box of items. And so I thought I'd make some drawings of them, pencil and paper. I didn't know what else to do. I was quite a busy summer, quite distracted, had to get back to uni, had to fulfil the brief. And when my tutors looked at it, they said, maybe you need to find a different way to work. You know, the drawings haven't really quite worked. Some are okay. And then one of my tutors said to me, yeah, so just don't draw, Julie. Find another way to work. And please, whatever you do, promise me you won't draw people again. I'd had some drawings of people as well that I'd been looking at to do with my family and my late husband. And so I was at first a bit distraught, because I really like drawing, but it's always, and I was really good at drawing as a child, and I didn't understand what had happened from being a child. But of course, if you don't keep practicing something, you lose it. Mm. And so I went away and I started drawing, like you do, with your eyes closed or with a stick, a pencil on a long stick, or and then I started drawing with my sewing machine, and I thought, I know what I'll do. I won't worry about what's gone wrong. I'll let all the bits that go wrong become part of the work, because then I just can free myself up and I'm not worried about how somebody judges it, because I've left mistakes in it. And so that's just freed up this, you know, the my drawing. And so then I drew a picture of a camera. That was the first thing I did. Didn't particularly enjoy the free machine embroidery. Found it quite laborious. But anyway, I completed the piece of work. And that was my first attempt at drawing with my sewing machine. And that won a prize at the Royal West of England Academy for students. So this teacher who told me, I mean, I have to say, she was right about the drawings that I'd made. But I guess it was a bit more difficult to say, actually, don't draw, because how many of us get told not to draw and then it just puts us off completely? So anyway, as you know, then from the camera, I then made, there was the Bristol 2-litre engine, and then I sort of moved through challenging myself with the drawing process. And then I remembered the, and don't draw people. In 2012 on my BA, I'd taken a photograph of this couple on the tube. I'd seen them sitting there. And I guess I'm quite fascinated by people. I mean, I've worked for the NHS for a long time, and I retired, finished that now. And obviously being in a relationship where your husband sort of dies and it takes his own life, and so I guess there's this fascination between interaction between people and what is actually going on. When I was a midwife, you saw some of the things that were going on behind. So anyway, I got my sister to sit, and this couple were on the tube, and they didn't move, they didn't say a word, they didn't speak to each other, they were just motionless, and they just had their view, and their view was fixed. So I said to my sister, go and sit by the side of them, and I'm going to pretend that I'm taking a photograph of you, that picture of the couple on the tube. But anyway, that was in 2012, and it probably wasn't until 2016 that I just kept thinking about this picture. I thought, I'm going to try and draw that. I'm going to challenge myself to drawing people. I know I can draw a car engine. I know I can draw some inanimate objects, but can I do people? And then I just started with the eyes, and they didn't work. And I think, now maybe that's right. And then I restarted again, and I got the eyes right, and then I moved on to the next part, and I would just start in one part and I kept moving on to the next bit. Every part was a challenge. You know, I did the eyes and I had to get the lips right, then I had to get the skin right, and then I had to do her hair, and everything I moved through became another challenge. And there were times that I'd been working on the drawing for about, you know, maybe 6 or 9 months, and then I would get to the carrier bag, and then I'd think, oh my gosh, this drawing's not going to work. I spent all that time. How do I get the carrier bag to be translucent? How do I get... And I just kept moving through the picture like that. And I got to the hands. And that took me about 2 weeks to try and draw the hands. And that was how I just moved through the picture. So I spent about 2 years making it, because I had to keep going back to it and add other things happening at the same time. And to be working on something where you've got a year and a half's work, and then you've got to another problem on the drawing and you're trying to resolve it. And if you don't resolve it, the rest of the work is... it's not going to be used. And I just kept working through it like that. And then at the end, I had to do my usual thing. I had to pin it onto some foam loft boards and take it outside and hose it down. So 2 years of work, because it's all made on dissolved fabric, then it gets hosed down in the garden. And it's quite spectacular. And then you just have to leave it to dry, and you have to wait and see what's happened.
Yeah.
So this idea that you can obsessively control over the stitch, and then you don't know at the end, you just throw all that away. So I made it because I was challenging myself. I never believe in my, I find it really difficult to believe in myself. So I'll make things that are just challenging and trying to prove that, you know, there is a worth to my work and that I can create. But I say, so, yeah, and a piece of work is still behind me.
Can I ask a dumb question? When you do, say, for instance, when you're doing the bag, when you're trying to do the translucence, do you do that on separate things? Do you have like lots of little test pieces where you feel it out before applying your skill to the total piece?
Yeah, I've been asked that so many times and it's really interesting. I would test out colours. I'll have a small piece of dissolvable fabric about sort of that fits into a 20 centimetre hoop, and I'll work in sort of 1 centimeter squares to test out the colours, because each colour, because it's thread, I can't blend them like I can blend paints. The threads I've got is what I have to work with. So I will have different colour thread at the top and a different colour at the bottom, and then I will alter the tensions. So I do that to try and work out what threads I need to use. But when it actually comes to practicing, to try and experiment with the plastic bag, the carrier bag, I have to do it in the main piece of work, because if I do it on the hoop, on my trial piece, then because there's so many layers to whatever step I'm doing, unless I keep really careful records, I can't remember. So I just tend to go launch straight into the piece of work. And if it hasn't worked, you can cut something out.
Right.
And every now and again, I might experiment with some layers of colour. If I'm trying to work out how to make it translucent, I might experiment a little bit, but mostly it's in the piece of work,
because right.
It's the only place where I can really apply myself and really attempt to get it to work, because it's such a lengthy process.
It's interesting as well in that there's a sort of engineering element to this, isn't it? As we were saying, like with Meredith Warnow, techniques very similar, machine stitching on soluble canvas, and she said, you know, there's, you have to build up the stitches to such a point where they've got their own integrity, so that, and I think you found this with your camera, didn't you, when you dissolve away the fabric, it kind of melts a little bit on you, it kind of changes and doesn't have the structure that you intended. So I suppose, is that a process of trial and error? Or with that piece at the end, did you just hose it and be like, dear Lord, please don't let this melt. You know, please let it hold up.
it's what's really interesting about that is when I was widowed through suicide, when really awful life events have happened, you try really hard to control everything in your life because you don't want anything else to go wrong. And first of all, you can't really, it's very difficult to use the word suicide and to talk about what's happened, especially, it's just really difficult because of the history of the word suicide and the difficulties I have been around talking about it. So this would play out in my work. So I would, you know, internalize this and I would be trying and I'd be making work and obsessing over it. But then there was this idea that at the end of the making, I then, by pinning it onto these boards and washing it, I'm just throwing all that control. So what happens? How do I feel when something I've been working on or something in my life I've been trying to control doesn't go the way I want it to, or it falls apart or it moves? So that's what was really interesting. So every time I make a piece of work and when I dissolve the backing, I do look at it and think, oh, I'm really disappointed. That's not quite what I wanted. Something's moved, or there's a hole, or there's a, you know, and sometimes it can take me a few days before I can fall back in love with the piece of work. I've had to come to terms with what's happened in this stage of the making.
It sounds analogous to parenthood.
Yeah, exactly. And parenting, when you're all grieving and you're all so confused. So the work was really good, because and my boys loved the work as well. They were really supportive. So it was good for all of us. They could see me making something. There would be lots of discussions amongst us. Or what did he think of the piece afterwards and what had gone wrong? And it was really interesting with the camera. There was, because that was the first piece, spent a little bit of time trying to decide if I should repair it, if I should fix the part where it had fallen, where it had moved, should I fix them? And then I sort of appreciated the beauty in those flaws. I just thought they were more significant maybe than the piece of work even. So as I got better at the process, there is slightly less flaws.
That's why I was thinking in terms of like the parenthood thing, you know, you try and bring children up and you try and control the way that they grow and evolve, but at a certain point you have to let them go. And I'm not necessarily thinking of disappointment, but there's that, I've made this thing and now the world gets to adapt to it or something. And so it's that similar process.
Yeah.
But I was also then thinking about when I interviewed Kaz Holmes, she talked, you know, she uses found objects and she doesn't really start a piece of work with an agenda. So there's a kind of thrill in the unknown, the sort of alchemy. And I suppose there's an element of that, as you say, do you try and hold on to the original vision, or do you go, actually, this is some kind of partnership? There's a partnership where I'm creating and the fabric is creating, and then you're working together as best you can.
And I think it's really interesting, but and it's not sometimes necessarily to do with the outcome. For me, it's more about how did I feel about it? How did I process it? What did I learn from that? As well as the fact that I've got a piece of work that I can show to people and have a conversation about.
But the interesting thing is, if you wanted total control, then you could just stitch it on a fabric that wasn't dissolvable, couldn't you? So you're always giving yourself that jeopardy.
And I need to give myself that jeopardy to give myself some freedom. Because once I'm on fabric and it doesn't move, then I have these preconceived ideas. There's a camera. That's what the camera should look like. But by having this element of, you know, being on dissolvable fabric, I think maybe the jeopardy is a bit that I like, and I like seeing how far I can push that. So that's where I now it's got to a point. Well, the jeopardy is not quite. The jeopardy is less. It's lessened off now because now I've got better at the process. So that's a really interesting. And then you think, well, what can I? But of course, when I got to start on my MA at the Royal College of Art, I guess there I was opening myself up again to be, you know, to kind of put myself in a very uncomfortable position because I was going there with an established practice. But and by then it was becoming successful. But then I was going to be challenged again. My making was going to be completely challenged. And that's exactly what they did. And I got there and they said, why do you only draw with a sewing machine?
And you went, I need to tell you about this person who said I shouldn't draw at all. Just before we go on to the MA, because I do want to talk about that, because that's interesting. One of the things I find interesting if you do free machine embroidery is like when you draw with a pen, you control the pen. Or when you paint with a brush, you control the brush. But when you do free machine embroidery, you control the surface. So it's almost like it's like undrawing or something. You know, I think it's interesting. It's almost like you're doing the opposite thing, aren't you? Because people don't write that way. I don't know. Obviously, it's something that resonated with you. I just wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that because I always say to people, well, I use my sewing machine as a way to draw. But of course, it is completely different. I am moving the fabric around and I am a little bit at the whim of the sewing machine as well, because sometimes, you know, it might catch or it might, or the threads might break and then you have to start again. Whereas normally when you're just drawing a line, you can just keep continuing that line, but you get interrupted lots of ways with a sewing machine and also with the same. And of course, when you are moving that piece of material around underneath as well, that is stretching and moving and holes are turning up in it. So the whole process is one that is just open to things going wrong. And so when you get it right, I guess still, like I say, it's still that idea of jeopardy. And maybe that's because I'm not very confident and I need to find a way to throw off my inhibitions. And I definitely need that element of jeopardy. I need that element of things going wrong, because then I don't know. I really think it gives me a lot more freedom to create.
The one thing that's fascinating, and I don't want this to drift into too much of a therapy session, but intentionally putting jeopardy into work doesn't sound like someone who's not very confident. It sounds like someone who's like, come on, I need a bit of a challenge. The challenge is always there.
Yeah, I do need a bit of a challenge as well. I think that is right, because it's quite exciting when you have a challenge and then it's disappointing. And if you can't make something work, you can be a bit hard on yourself. But I just think unless you have these, take these challenges, unless things go wrong, you're not then going to find the way, a way forward. You have to have mistakes. Things have to go wrong in the making. People have to say things that you're not sure about or maybe are a bit uncomfortable, because without those happening, the next new thing doesn't happen. You know, I think mistakes and are absolutely pivotal in my making, and the comments that I've had from people that have, because we can have these comments and we can just think, oh, that's it, I finished. But if you take some time, people make these comments because normally they're making them because they want to help you, because they've got a valid point. And okay, maybe you can still disagree with a valid point, but if that tutor hadn't challenged me about my drawing, I wouldn't have started stitching with my sewing machine. If my husband hadn't died, I wouldn't have been making pieces of work like I was, his camera and his car engine. I wouldn't have been making them. I wouldn't have been at the summer exhibition. I wouldn't have been showing a piece of work that was all about it. I don't know where my making would have gone if the tragedy hadn't happened to our family.
Do you think that people, because what you're talking about is resilience, I think, and do you think people can learn resilience? Like, can you learn resilience from a book, or do you think the only way you can get resilience is to get beaten up a bit?
Oh, I think resilience is so hard. You know, it's affected by so many other things. It's affected by, you know, your health. It's affected by what's happening outside to the weather. It's affected by how your children are doing. You know, so many things. Mm-hmm. I think the thing is to realise that resilience is it's a bit of a hard one thing, and you have to realise that there's sometimes when your resilience is just down, and you just have to acknowledge that. You just have to think, oh, this is a day where, you know, this isn't working, and I don't have the motivation or the ability to make it work. But just knowing that's not going to last, because it will come back, and lots of different things in life can affect, you know, when it comes back and how much you value it. So I know there are times when my resilience is it's really minimal, and then you have to make some changes and you have to do something about it, or you just have to give yourself a bit of time to go for a walk, or today's not a day that I'm going to be making. But when you've got that fight and you're really and you're really enthusiastic about what you're doing, then it's just something that's to be so grateful for. So I really value, you know, resilience is it's a bit of a hard one thing, and there are times when we're better at it and there are times when we're not as good. And I think that's okay.
I sometimes think if you're like getting that feedback from your tutor, I don't think you should draw anymore, is pretty brutal. I mean, I'm sure it was couched hopefully more sensitively than that, but that can be hard to take when you're at an age where you're not used to that kind of thing, isn't it? And that's what I think I'm just wondering is, you know, the older you get, the less we care about people's opinions, but also we've had a few bumps and scrapes regardless of our circumstance. So you do get a bit tougher. Whereas trying to say to someone who might be like an A-level student going, look, because I always think about the good news sandwich, which is always like, you know, I love your hair. I'm afraid you're fired. I'm going to miss your hair. That sort of thing. So they go out on a high note, you know. I think that's something where, but yeah, how you build that perseverance and that kind of resilience is a whole nother matter, really.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose for me, what was... you know, we'd had something far worse happen. You know, we'd lost, and we'd had this really, really big thing happen. And it's almost, some days you can't, but other days you can use that to good. And you can just think, well, I've managed that.
Would you like to, in the way that's best for you, would you like to tell the tale of what happened with Carl? The way that is best for you.
Yes. Well, I think before 2009, I'd always been a bit of a... men are quite often a bit grumpy, aren't they? You know, my dad was a bit grumpy. One of my brothers would be a bit grumpy.
I'm quite grumpy.
You know, 40, you know, children, working. It can be a bit grumpy, and I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't, because in those days, you didn't talk about the word suicide. My son got told off in primary school because we'd used the word at home because it happened in our community, and we'd used the word. When my son went to school, he got told off, or I got asked to come in because he'd used the word suicide. And the teacher thought it was really inappropriate. And so that's what we were. And I just remember it was a time when there was such a stigma, so nobody talked about mental health. And I knew that Carl's mum had also taken her own life, but it was never a conversation that Carl wanted to talk about. It was all kept very, very quiet. It wasn't even on his GP record. It was on his GP record that she died a different way. So, but of course, when she died in the 80s, that was just the way it was. It was really, people didn't talk about that. So that's what Carl was used to. And nothing right or wrong about that, because that was just the way it was in the time. We're only in the 80s, we started to understand the importance that we do need to chat. So that takes a long time. So I never really talked about it. I thought he was just, maybe he was a bit grumpy, a bit difficult. And we, you know, sat in the pub a few days before he died, having, you know, a drink and a chat about cycling. So I'm a really keen cyclist, and we were sort of talking about pros and, you know. As we got forward through November and into December, the weather had been really bad, and not just the weather, it was really grey. So I always remember, you know, these grey days. And I came home from our college, and there was a big letter on the side, a big brown envelope, and I just thought, well, that's odd. And it had my name on it, and it was really official. And anyway, that was all letters. It was a big sort of brown envelope full of where we would find him.
Right.
So contact with the police, and they didn't tell us anything. Then we would try it, and I'd go and pick up my boys from tennis, and then we would phone the police again, and still we couldn't get anything, and we didn't know what was happening, and we didn't know where he was, and what had happened. And then I think about 6 o'clock, the police turned up. So it's just like a scene out of EastEnders, really. So my youngest was 8, and my eldest was 10, really. Was 10. And it was just the most impossible situation, as you can probably imagine. But it was made a bit... And it's been a real battle. It's been up and down ever since that happened. Just because of dealing with generation age gaps who decide it's best thing to do is not talk about it. So there's about sort of being too critical of different things that happened, you know, because it is a very difficult situation and people don't really know how to react, and everybody responds to the way that they think they should. But my friends were amazing, and we've had lots of ups and downs, and but my boys have come out the other side, and we had some real difficulties with one of my youngest when he was sort of doing A levels, and because we lost my dad and he was really close to my dad. But what's happened sort of now, we are a bit further down the line, both my boys are doing really well. One of them has got a job over in Cambridge. He went to Manchester Uni, and he's got a really good job. He's very happy. And the other one who's in his third year at university, doing aerospace engineering and doing really well. And we're all really close. So I really enjoy my small family unit that I've got. I find it difficult sometimes sort of moving outwards in family circles, but you know, our nuclear family is, so and my boys love a lot of the things that that Carl did. Carl was a software engineer, really loved science, physics, making things, all the things that the boys are, traveling, all the things that the boys are interested in. So they do so many things that he did, and we talk about him a lot, but it never goes away.
No.
And it's really bizarre. It's really funny that the work I make, I used to have a conversation with Carl about art and the merits of, he would never really quite understand, I guess, sort of contemporary art. And we would always, and he really liked the art he appreciated was where he would look at something and he couldn't work out how somebody could possibly make it. And it's just bizarre that I ended up with a medium that he probably would have really valued. So So I think he's a big part of my making. And every time I'm making, you know, he's a big part of it. So it has been a really difficult sort of time. But when you have these difficult times, when it's really good, you really appreciate it.
Yeah.
So I remember being at the summer exhibition in 2018 with my piece of work on the wall, and some of my friends who'd helped me so much through all the difficult times were there to celebrate this piece of work being in a summer exhibition. That was probably the best part of it, and being there with my boys. So, but like we're saying about resilience, it's like managing sort of that kind of loss. You know, you get, it doesn't go away. You get used to managing it, and you get used to integrating it into your life. And I think it's changed a lot of things about me, but some things to the good. I've learned a lot. I've learned an awful lot about, you know, suicide and reading lots of other people who found different ways to cope with it and using art or writing. So,
is it easier?
And it's a part of us now.
Yeah. Is it easier to talk about it? Not for you, but do as a society we have a better language for talking about it now?
Oh, we have a much better language now for talking about it. I mean, it's still difficult. There's still some people who are saying things like, gosh, that's such a selfish thing to do. And you're just thinking, it's completely, completely not selfish. They think they're making a decision that is going to be better for everybody else. They don't realise how much they're going to be missed. And I always just think to myself, if only I'd asked him that day when he was leaving to go to work. And but for a lot of time, for my making, I couldn't talk about, I find it difficult to talk about it. It wasn't obvious. It was a bit subtle. My making mirrored how I lived my life. But I didn't actually, the conversation around suicide didn't come up unless somebody asked me, why did I make a car engine? And when I explained that I made a car engine because I was doing drawings that were these jobs that I'd had to take over because Carl wasn't there anymore. And I had to, suddenly it was my, I had to fix things. I had to put, if something broke, that was my job to repair it. And then one day I was lifting the bonnet of the car, and I thought, a car engine, he used to do this. He used to put the oil in. He used to check the tire pressures. So that's why I drew the car engine. So unless people ask me why I might have made a piece, it wasn't obvious. It wasn't obvious until I got to the Royal College of Art. And then I really found my voice. But it has really changed. It's really changed now. I mean, you can mention the word suicide now without people being horrified that you mentioned it. People are always sad and are always very compassionate. But it's a word that we're now more familiar with. And that can only be, it's very sad that more, but it's only, can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
Had I been more familiar, maybe I would have asked Carl some questions.
Yeah, if people want help with this subject, where are the best places for them to turn?
So I, obviously, we had support with a local charity called the Rainbow Centre. So I'd always say to Winston's Wish are really good. We had contact with Winston's Wish. And also, it's really funny how you can find out normally by word of mouth, asking friends. Somebody will always know a place or somebody who's offered support. There's some really good books on the subject, because one of the most horrible things about death through suicide, if somebody's had cancer, there's been a lot of time to come to terms with it, and you found out a lot about the illness, about why they might have caught the illness, why they died. But with suicide, you don't know any, you can't answer any of those questions. You have lots and lots of questions that you can't answer. But what's quite, there's lots of books that help you. They don't give you the answers, but they help you to understand the questions that you're asking. And so sort of help just crops up in the most unusual places. It might be a book that somebody might recommend. It might be a piece of work that you're seeing in an exhibition. It might be having a conversation with somebody. But I also think, obviously, as well, I mean, Mind are always really good as well. So there's, the most important thing is, you know, it could just be getting help from the person that you're sat next to, just telling somebody.
Yeah.
And also for us to actually really listen. I mean, how often do we say to somebody, you know, how are you? And people say, I'm fine. It just becomes a way to greet, as opposed to being a way to really ask how somebody is.
Yeah. And especially men as well. Men just don't want to talk about it, do we? I like to stew in my own brain. And the thing is, you can be self-aware about it. Like, I can be like, oh, I've got this thing that's really annoying me. And rather than talk to my wife, my best friend, I'll just sit and be a grumpy twat for the rest of the day. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, what? Men, come on.
I know. And that's a really important thing. And that is the one thing where my boys are really good. So, mostly I hear about the things that go wrong and they do tell me. So I just keep thinking, oh, you know, that's what I needed to achieve. I just needed to have two sons who would talk about or do Fame in the Night at 2:30. Something's gone wrong. And you're just thinking, OK, I've got to sort this out. But oh my gosh, they've just phoned me. You know, so whatever it is not insurmountable. We can sort it because you've made that call, because you've made contact with me. Yeah. So now we can help to sort it. But by not making the contact, you know, that's it's just the most important thing, really.
Yeah,
to talk and for people to listen.
Yeah. My wife's dad died of a heart attack all of a sudden when she was 17, and she's got three siblings and her mum's still alive. And they're such a close-knit family because of that. Like, it's a horrific thing, and you wouldn't wish death on anybody. But in these circumstances, the one thing that comes out of it is just such a strength. They're such a unit, that family, that, I mean, that's a sort of, it's a poignant beauty, I suppose.
It is, actually. It is. We can't control the things that happen to us in life, like when I'm trying to control my stitches. But it doesn't mean to say, and some things are just so awful and you think, how can I get over this? But you do. I mean, you might not get over it. It just becomes a part of you. But but you can still carry on living after it. And things can be better, exactly, as you say, because my relationship with my boys is really good and we love having time, spending time together. And so I really, really value that. I mean, obviously, I wish Carl could be here with us to share and to sort of enjoy it as well in the plans that we had for our future. But everybody's plans, plans do change. It's quite hard to accept that, but they do change.
Yeah. And he still remains your muse.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. And there's somebody else on Instagram as well, and she suffered a loss, through suicide as well. And that's where the making is really good, because I really think about my making and before I put things on Instagram. But then when you have these conversations with people, so again, when you say that about where can people get help from, it's amazing. You know, on our community on Instagram, you know, especially with textiles, it is quite amazing, and people and when you're reading, you're quite humbled that people are responding in the way that they are with such honesty as well. So it's a really value being a member of the textile community. I think it's I think we're really fortunate.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.